Right. So I'm calling this talk self-power, other power. So we just finished our continuous practice retreat last night. I think next year I'm going to call it a session because it sure felt like one. Even though we didn't stay here at the Zendo, we had a full schedule. And session always brings up, you know, we have to make all this effort. Even if you're just trying to sit shikantaza and not do anything as you sit there, it takes effort just to sit there and just to show up again and just to stay awake and just to. So there's all this effort involved. And it's like, it has its merits. It has its, you know, it's very fruitful in a certain way, but it also kind of causes a paradox in that we're not supposed to be trying to make anything happen. We're supposed to be just being. Well, then, I like to think of it as, you know, not just Zazen, but our practice is like walking on a slack line. You know, it's kind of like a wide ribbon suspended between two posts or trees, and it's kind of, you know, it's a little bit slack, and our Zazen is like trying to walk on that. And, you know, it's very easy to kind of fall off on one side or the other with vow, aspiration, will, intention. We know something is required. Why else would we be doing this? We don't want to simply be buffeted about by the winds of karma. We're just going with the karmic flow or the path of least resistance, right? To just like, well, whatever, I'll just let my mind wander, fall asleep, whatever. Like, okay, that's not it. But then grasping the will, I compared it yesterday to like trying to grab a greased pig. Kyogen had a nice, it's a very inelegant metaphor, but it's accurate. He says, it's like you've got a bowling ball in a bucket that just fits the bowling ball, and the bowling ball's a little bit oily, and you need to like lift the bowling ball out of that bucket, right? Like just kind of keep contact with it until the oil gets a little bit sticky, and then lift it up. And if you try too hard, it's going to slip back down. So, I mean, it's really humbling and quite a lesson in no self to sit, you know, sit Zazen, particularly sit in session when things get rather difficult, and to just think, okay, I'm just going to sit, I'm just going to just be and let go of thoughts, and then just like, well, I don't know what just happened in the last half an hour. Like, it just, where did that intention go? It just didn't happen the way that we intended. And you know, the more years that you practice like this, the more it's just kind of like, come on, by this point, really? Like, I should be able to make this happen. I should be able to drop everything. And then when we break through, when we kind of remember what this is all about, when the stuckness gives way, then we recognize, oh, and I was just getting my own way. It was just an idea about what I needed to do. Well, then why can't we remember that and apply that, right? Somebody yesterday at the end of retreat was talking about just being stuck in resistance. Just stuck, right? And you're like, I should give up this resistance. But it can just cause more, right? So it really, sometimes the very aspiration to practice can seem anyway to cause us more suffering or confusion or angst. So it led me to want to talk about a interesting teaching about self-power and other power. So self-power in Japanese Buddhism is jiriki, and other power is tariki. And it is thought that Zen represents the path of jiriki, self-power, and then Pure Land Buddhism represents the path of other power, tariki. So in Pure Land Buddhism, if any of you are not familiar, and I apologize if this is a, you know, kind of an inaccurate or incomplete portrayal, as often happens when you're talking about somebody else's religion. The basic premise is that it's really hard to awaken in this lifetime. So in the middle of session, they're like, I can get that, right? Like, this is really hard. So it's really hard. And therefore, Amida Buddha, so this isn't Shakyamuni Buddha, this is another, like in Mahayana Buddhism, we dream up many different Buddhas. And Amida Buddha made a vow to create a pure land where when we die, if we have cultivated sincere devotion, that we can be reborn in the pure land where it is easy to awaken. It won't be so hard. So that cultivating that devotion, but as I'm going to talk about today, what does that really mean to completely cultivate devotion? And so I would like to find the source of this this saying, but I've heard that in Japanese Buddhism, they say Zen and Pure Land are like two ends of a tunnel. So you enter through one and you have to exit through the other. So you enter through self-power, and at some point you have to kind of exit through other. Or and if you enter through other power, at some point the self has to get involved. So in my experience of this, happened very early on in my Buddhist path, when, you know, back in, yes, it would have been like 95, I decided, I had been reading a little bit about Buddhism, and I decided to like look up a Zen. So they said you're supposed to have a Sangha. Okay. All right. So I looked it up in the phone book, and so I just started attending different places. And the first place I attended was Oregon Buddhist Temple over on Powell, which still exists. And it is a Pure Land temple. And, you know, they have pews, and everybody was really nice and friendly.
They have hymn books.
And they have hymn books, and they sing, and they, it's, you know, it's praises to Amida, and the, you know, you recite Namu Amida Buddha. Namu is homage to, so they, you know, use malas, and like with each bead of the mala, it's homage, you know, Namu Amida Buddha, Namu Amida Buddha. And so they'll, that's like a kind of like their form of meditation, if you will. Anyway, it was lovely. But then afterwards, there was a little, I don't know, tea meeting, and people were talking and reflecting on, you know, why they had chosen this path. They had chosen this path, you know, because it's very difficult to get enlightened, and they wanted to cultivate devotion to Amida instead. And because, you know, they weren't up for that, you know, self-power stuff like Zen. So I just was like, gotta go home and look up Zen. It's like, thank you guys. Thanks, you know, more power to you, but now I know where I'm supposed to go. So, you know, because I had left, you know, I had left Christianity in part. I thought it was a kind of a lovely thing, but I just didn't believe. So, how do they relate self-power and other power? So I found this neat little essay by D.T. Suzuki. He says, Asahara Saichi, is was a Shin Buddhist. Shin as the Japanese term for like the Pure Land Buddhist, the devotional Buddhist. Asahara Saichi spent his entire life in Yunotsu, a small village in the Iwami province. But the Shin Buddhist type of Anjin that he arrived at is truly remarkable. So this article is called Anjin, Peaceful Awareness in Zen and Shin. So Anjin, A-N-J-I-N. So peaceful awareness. So this Shin Buddhist, the type of Anjin that he arrived at is truly remarkable. Where exactly true Shin Buddhist Anjin lies is something that this writer, because D.T. Suzuki had studied Zen, is not completely sure about. But as far as traditional Shin Buddhist Anjin goes, it is possible that on certain counts, he might be considered to be I Anjin or off the mark. As for me, however, I'm not inclined to draw up any hard or fast definition of Anjin, whereby one form might be judged genuine and another false. I would prefer a much more elastic, free form of peaceful awareness in which the living, breathing Anjin can be clearly seen. In either case, I am highly sympathetic to Saichi's form of Anjin. One day, while fashioning a wooden clog or geta, Saichi wrote down his feelings just as they came to him on a piece of wood, originally intended perhaps as a support for the geta. Worried over this, worried over that, that heavy burden has been taken away from me. Ever since the burden was taken away, how perfectly at peace I am. So Suzuki continues, reading this poem reminds me of Bodhidharma's declaration to Eka, which I'm going to share with you right now. So he cites this Zen koan, which is, Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. So the Hoika is coming to Bodhidharma asking to be his student. But Bodhidharma just ignores him, continues meditating. So Hoika cries, my mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind. Bodhidharma says, bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you. And I'm imagining that Hoika goes off and, you know, tries. Okay. But then he comes back and says, I have searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it. And Bodhidharma says, now your mind is pacified. So in the notes on this koan by Sekida, it's really sweet. He kind of comments on each little phrase. And one of them is, I beg you. And Sekida says, there's no point in begging for one's peace of mind, but one cannot help doing it all the same. My mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, please pacify my mind. Or, you know, it's not like, probably not like Hoika's really asking Bodhidharma, like, would somehow you pacify my mind? But how can I pacify my mind? Please teach me how. Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you. So Mumon's verse on this koan is coming east directly pointing. You entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. So coming east and directly pointing is, he's addressing Bodhidharma who came from India to China with the Dharma. You entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you. So I like this to think of this as, Seki does notes on this. This was raising waves where there was no wind. When one keeps to ordinary mind, there is no problem about life. But Bodhidharma introduced a troublesome theme and started a struggle in Ekka to attain enlightenment. In fact, when the struggle is over and the ordinary condition of mind is restored, one finds that everything is all right. What is all this fuss about nothing? It's kind of like over and over we experience that, right? Just, please, how can I pacify my mind? And then when it's pacified, we're like, what? That's the... there's no problem. And then the very effort sometimes to practice or calm the mind just agitates us even more. So to continue with Suzuki's observation about Shin, other power versus self-power. Says Shin Buddhism is Tariki, other power. And Zen is Jiriki, self-power, or so it is generally assumed. But that is rather a superficial observation. At bottom, when you really get down to it, there is no Jiriki and no Tariki. Or you might say that both are Jiriki and both are Tariki. Zen involves religious practice and koans, and so it is generally regarded as being more Jiriki. But in the final analysis, you actually come to transcend the self. In Shinshu, you have Amida Buddha. But even in the case of Amida Buddha's Tariki, it is not possible for Amida Buddha to bestow his compassion on someone for whom there is no cause or condition. Even in the case of unconditional love and compassion, there has to be a person who becomes aware that they are the object of that unconditional love. In short, whether something is Jiriki or Tariki is a moot question. Again, Saichi wrote a poem that makes this perfectly clear. In other power, there is no self-power, no other power. All around is other power. Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu. So my teacher Kyogen said that in practice and in life, probably, the harder we try at something, the we will meet an equal and opposing force, just like physics. It's like the physics of vow and intention. They're just So as we are making our efforts, you know, on that slack line, on the one side, acceptance, right? Acceptance of our limitations, our obstacles, many people who, you know, want to attend retreat or want to sit zazen, face a lot of obstacles, physical obstacles, bodies that don't let them, you know, sit long or participate, life circumstances that don't let them do that. So there's these obstacles. So acceptance, okay, this is how things are, you know, can have a good quality, but it also can be kind of a passivity, right? And anybody who deals with like physical issues knows this, like you, mind and body are not separate. So there is a place for like trying to do more than just completely like rest and not push the body, right? And yet clearly you can push too hard and inappropriately and then do damage. And, you know, so, you know, you're always navigating that, like, how much can I ask of my body and how much is too much? So we're going, you know, back and forth. There's diligence versus striving. So, okay, we're going to make an effort. We're going to show up. Yes. But then so easily that just becomes a tool of the ego that's trying to make something happen, and then we're foiled. Taking responsibility versus recognizing what is beyond our control. I mean, this is just like the classic serenity prayer bit. Like, can I do anything about this? Maybe I can do something about this. Maybe I should get a new job. Maybe I should change my life circumstances. Maybe I should, you know, sleep more, or maybe who knows what, like or maybe I need to, you know, practice harder, change my attitude, versus recognizing what is really beyond our control. And then just, you know, learning how to embrace that. And so we're constantly falling off on one side or the other. So the key to this kind of, well, all of that still applies, but at a deeper level, what we're looking for is to find a place of peace, to truly make this skin bag, this life, this is our path. This is where we are manifesting it. So to this is what Dogen's talking about, at least in part, in the Genjo Koan, when he says, when a fish swims, no matter how far it swims, it doesn't reach the end of the water. When a bird flies, no matter how high it flies, it cannot reach the end of the sky. When the bird's need or the fish's need is great, the range is large. When the need is small, the range is small. In this way, each fish and each bird uses the whole of space and vigorously acts in every place. We cannot step outside of ourselves. We will always be in this limited mind and body and set of conditions. So that can feel really limiting, particularly if, you know, here's an example. There are some of us in this world, in this Sangha, who have very busy minds, and for whom the instructions, like in original Buddhism, of disciplining the mind, of, you know, bringing it back to its meditative object, and then over time the mind will become calm. And it's like, when? And I practiced, despite having compassionate teachers, I practiced for many, many years thinking I am just, there's something wrong with me. I am just so inadequate. Either my will is inadequate, or my discipline, or my mind, or something is just woefully inadequate. And that still comes up. You go to session, you're sitting there, you're just like, oh God, can I do this? So if I am stuck in this experience, what does it mean to practice with this? Dogen says, if there are fish that would swim or birds that would fly, only after investigating the entire ocean or sky, they would find neither path nor place. When we make this very place our own, our practice becomes the actualization of reality. Like, I'm not gonna escape from this. And honestly, if you look closely at the things that you would like to escape from, most of the time, you might not, if you had the choice, you might not actually get rid of that, because then you wouldn't be who you are. There's what manifests in us and in our lives always has two sides. My busy mind feels like a great flaw when I am trying to be a Zen meditator. But it's very beneficial in other aspects. It's very, you know, it writes great podcasts. So, you know, it has a benefit. Would I really want to, like, somehow, if I could just like flip a switch and now I'm just going to pretty much just wander around all day, just, I'm just nowhere but right here. I would. But somehow when we make this very place our own, this very path, then we realize in what way all of that shit doesn't matter. It's not about that, right? It's not about somehow making our mind free, or, you know, keeping all our vows, or, you know, being a super Zen student, or understanding all aspects of the Dharma, or whatever it is that we might have built up as a sincere aspiration. But that's just one aspect of it. That's kind of our jiviki aspect of it, right? Of like, I really want to fulfill this. I want to do this. And it just, at some point, we just realize the limits of that. And then we can open up to other power. And I don't, you know, like many people, I'm not inclined to really project the other out there. I think for me, that would be like as big a mistake as thinking like, it's all me. I'm just this small little person here who's going to try to become perfect. But kind of like we were talking about in Sajiki ceremony, right? It was just, and we kind of let go of worrying about kind of whether it's literally true, just kind of give ourselves over to that practice. So I'm not inclined to be very devotional myself, but sometimes just turning the phrase to like, all right, I'm gonna stay awake now for this next period of Zazen. And I turn it to, may I stay awake this next period of Zazen? And then there's just, you know, it's in touch with my aspiration, but I'm also saying, I don't think I'm in control here, right? May I? What is it? Asking for that support. We don't have to imagine that there's a sentient force outside of us that answers our prayers. But you can, if you want. I mean, there are many, many Buddhists who really, you know, relate to Kanzeon in that way. For instance, the Bodhisattva of compassion, to really, you know, they really pray to her. It's, for whatever it's worth, it's useful to imagine there is this force of compassion that you can call upon. Some other ways to cultivate that other power. I think, you know, other people can throw things out, but focusing on a sense of gratitude, you know, we're always focused on like kind of the flaws and the obstacles and whatever, but, you know, just, I think most of us were raised Christian or Jewish or in a culture where that permeates. So for me, it is very easy to, you know, call up, like, what would a theist say? And, you know, thank you for the gifts. I wish you make this chronic illness go away, Lord, but thank you for the continued life and the roof over my head and whatever, to turn our minds toward gratitude. Even that thy will be done, you know, we want our lives to go in this way, and it's not. You know, that what is that transformation of heart? And we really say, you know, thy will be done. But I mean, there's internally still kind of resist, like thy will. I don't know, there's no, but I can shift that in my own heart, right? Of just this is bigger than me. It's kind of a mystery. How did it all end up this way? And I will just bow. So, in order to leave time for a few comments and questions, this was the poem that Suzuki, D.T. Suzuki, ended his article with. And this is another poem of Saichi, the Shin Buddhist. What joy I have received. It is the two characters, Namu, that lead me to entrust myself to Amida. Where your heart is filled with joy, there is Namu. I, Saichi, am simply working on and on. Now that you, Amida, have taken away my suffering, this working body is itself Namu Amida Butsu. How easy this is, how joyful this is, how enlightening this is. Very, very easily, easily and easily again, I live on in this world.
Courtney. The part that you've said about effort with the like making waves where there is no wind is something that I keep touching on and not knowing, like it's given me some words to like verbalize something I keep touching on. There are times like during like the Dharma discussion period or during a class where we start getting into the weeds of like this word or that concept or, but it really this, but, and at some point I'm just like, why are we making it so complicated? It's really not that big a deal. I can touch that. I don't really understand what it actually is, but I know it's not that big a deal. And I feel like the image that comes to mind is a bunch of fish sitting around in the ocean, like diligently debating the existence or nature of water. I'm like, I know that it's not that big a deal. I still don't know what it is, but I know, like, I just like, what do we even do?
We can definitely get trapped with all of that stuff. On Tuesday, actually, will be the class on the Zen field of Dharma study. So we'll be exploring that. I like to say that our Dharma study is about challenging the ideas we have that we don't realize that we hold, not giving us new ones. But once we start talking words and concepts and all that, we can get off the track into the weeds, certainly. Greg.
Hey, I really liked how you use slacklining as a metaphor for Zen practice. And I'm not sure if you know this, but there's a really famous rock climber, base jumper and highliner called Dean Potter. And highlining is slacklining, but 1,000 feet or so up.
Oh my God.
But he, if you watch interviews with him, he's always talking about how he has this very busy sort of monkey mind. The way he describes it sounds like the monkey mind. And he says that the only way that, or he said it, he died base jumping, but he said that the only way To still his mind and to feel at peace and at one with everything is to highline. And he does it like most mortal human beings who highline will do it with a tether. So if you fall off, you don't die. But he says he did it without a tether. He said the only way to get to that state is to take the tether off. And so you can find videos of him doing this in Yosemite and all over online if that appeals to you. But it's just, we're just so lucky, like, that we found the thing that we're almost 100% guaranteed to survive to get to that state that some people are willing to die for. So I think we're just, it's really cool that we were all able to find this instead of having a highline to get to that place.
Thank you. And one other, certainly during session, I can taste that stillness that some people are blessed with experiencing more often. But I have to say, over the many years, like there, it happens more in daily life. But one of the other places was being Tenzo, the cook, at a really big session. And it was like my mind was so full of food and tasks and supervising people and getting the food out and whatever, that like when I did get to the cushion, it was just like there was no room left, right? It's just so it was like it took that much to consume all of my mind's energy. Jessica.
This is just something that came to me in your talk. In continuous practice, we are one with the Buddhas and ancestors. And to me, that feels like Tariki supporting Jiriki in a very non-linear way. That's how it felt.
Yes. Ewan.
Thanks for that, Domio. Strangely enough, as we were sitting zazen just before the talk, I was kind of experiencing a bit of pain with my condition, and I was thinking, I wonder if this is if I could frame this as a way of me being able to stay present, do you know, me experiencing pain as keeping me in my body and keeping me on the cushion, not mind spinning here, there, and everywhere. And I just thought it was strangely fortuitous that you were talking about not dissimilar things. And when you were talking, I was thinking about when I was first going to meetings for people experiencing chronic pain, one of the things they talk about, and it seems to be a pretty universal experience, is that people end up in a boom bust cycle, that when your body feels able to do things, you do as much as you can, and then you end up like a burst balloon, for want of a better expression, and completely flat. So you never actually get to that steady place without a real sort of conscious thought. And when you were talking about sort of striving and things, are just the way I've managed to get out of the boom bust cycle, not that I'm good at it, the way that I'm getting better at getting out of the boom bust cycle is through practice. And I'm slowly building up confidence and being able to engage in session, but it is still somewhat intimidating, both in terms of keeping my mind still for that length of time, and also the implications for not moving my body. But there's lots that I'll probably go back and listen again to this that to think about. So thank you very much.
Thank you. James.
When you were talking about Shing Buddhism and the focus on the Namu Amida mantra and the Pure Land and all of this, it brought to mind, as you referenced, that there's always kind of been this somewhat respectful tension between Zen and Pure Land in Japan. And the accounts that I had read, a lot of the Zen masters were a little dismissive of the Pure Land folk and thought that they had the better practice. You know, ours is superior to that. You know, they're just praying to get into the Pure Land. I'm actually working. And there's one account, and I can't remember which Zen master it was. I think it might have been Hakuin, but he's walking in the village and he encounters an old woman who is a known Shing Buddhist. And he sees an opportunity to, you know, get in a little bit. And he says, "Old woman, where is your Pure Land now?" And she looks at him and she goes, and just taps her heart three times and keeps going. And he's just, and in the account, he's just like, like, you know, she got him good. And it reminds me of how, like, just like what you were saying, like that. And even in Zazen, of that busy mind is just, it's trying to work things out and just trying to think about all these different, and it's just going and going and going and building up all this big, massive doubt. And then when it breaks open, it's like, for me, that's that other power. Like, I'm looking to other things to kind of give me the answer. I'm looking to teachings, or I'm looking to something. And it's only when that breaks open and I'm just left with just this, and then that self power can kind of take over. And it's like, oh, what was I fretting about? What have I been struggling so hard to try and find when it's just already right here? So I love that interplay between the self power and the other power as this kind of an internal, almost a yin yang that we, yeah, you know, kind of thing that we do with or to ourselves.
And that makes me, you know, the koan that I read about Bodhidharma, and, you know, Huayca says, you know, show me how to pacify my mind. Bodhidharma says, you know, bring me your mind. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's like, I can't find it. There, I pacified it for you. It sounds snarky, right? But if you read in between the lines and you realize Huayca went and was like, bring me my mind, what? And he sat with that, and he explored mind, and he explored this lack of pacification, and who's in charge of my mind, and all of that, you know, really firsthand direct experience, until, you know, something shifted and broke open, and he realized, like, you know, I don't know, this is all illusion, or there's, you know, I don't pacify my mind, or something like that, right? There was a real shift. So then when Bodhidharma says, there, I pacified your mind for you, and then through telling you to just investigate the mind and what that meant. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna parakita.